Good morning.
Good morning.
So, my name is Shen Shu. My last name is Roberts. Dajaku Kintz and I are the teachers at the Ocean Gate Zen Center, which is in Capitola, down the hill, very near Pleasure Point. Do you know where that is? Where all the surfers hang out down there at the end of the 41st Avenue. Let's see. I'm a Dharma heir of Sojin Mel Weitzman Roshi, and trained at San Francisco Zen Center for a little over 17 years. Jaku also trained at San Francisco Zen Center and is also a Dharma heir. Okay. Good morning. So this morning I wanted to talk about what it's like to be around what I call the lecture is a kind of violence fatigue. And this has come up in our group because, you know, there's been so much that has been going on recently in the United States. Of course, this has been going on all over the world for a very long time, probably as long as human beings have been around. But anyway, for us, there was the Boston Marathon, right? That explosion that just happened. Then the factory in West Texas blew up. We have a lot of government dysfunctionals going on right now in our country. There's the Syrian conflict. There's Palestine and Israel, and the Newtown killings at Sandy Hook Elementary School happened not too long ago. South Korea was going to theoretically lob a nuclear bomb onto California, I guess, or Hawaii. That was recent. That kind of got pushed down in the news by what happened in Boston. And then here locally, there's a lot of discussion about homelessness up in Santa Cruz and about the two police officers who were killed a few months ago. So, you know, it's so peaceful up here. I don't know how much of this you may be feeling, but I'm assuming that many of you do. Who actually lives here? So, but is everybody else? I mean, you guys are out in the world too. I mean, you're not just spending all your time here, so you know what's happening. So I think that sometimes in the midst of all of this stuff happening, you know, we say things in Buddhism like, well, everybody has basic goodness, right? And we're looking around and going, wow, how do I respond to this kind of feeling of this level of violence that's happening in the world right now? So I wanted to talk about that. Interestingly enough, which some of you may already know, there's something called secondary traumatic stress, which comes from being inundated constantly with all of these incidences of this kind of violence that's going on. So, for instance, in my case, since I, you know, live in a house and have a TV set, all of that kind of thing, you know, I noticed that CNN the news media was just like bombarding us constantly. Even when there wasn't really anything to say, it was on the news, the Boston Marathon bombing. So every time you turned on the television or read the newspaper, we're constantly surrounded by this kind of stuff. So it's difficult to get away from it. And I don't know whether we necessarily want to get away from it. I mean, that's another part of this. But we don't want to become so overwhelmed by it that we can't do our practice, that we can't function in the world. So what is it that Buddhism has to say to us about what it is to live in a world of suffering? So I thought I'd tell you this about this part of the Vimalakirti Sutra. So in the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti has decided that he's going to have lunch at his house. Do any of you know the Vimalakirti Sutra? In the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti feigns illness so that all these people come visit him. And he seems to live in a fairly small house, but like hundreds and thousands of people are able to cram into Vimalakirti's room. Okay, so it's kind of magical. There's a little magic going on here. So Subhuti's worried about lunch, and Vimalakirti says, well, I'll send an emissary. to another Buddha field. And the Buddha field he sent the emissary to was the Buddhist field of abundant, fragrant Buddha. And so the emissary, an emanation of Vimalakirti, arrives to kind of like say, can we have your leftovers? So he gets there and they say, the Buddha says, well, yes, of course, you can have our leftovers, which are like manna from heaven, right? They're fragrant, they're beautiful. So as soon as they're taken back to Vimalakirti's house, there's, first of all, they multiply to fit for everybody. At first, the Buddha's like going, well, I don't think there's enough food here. And Vimalakirti says, oh, you have little faith, right? And then suddenly there's all this food for everybody. And then the other bodhisattvas who are disciples of the Buddha in the land of fragrant abundance, the Buddha field of fragrant abundance, they say, well, you know, hey, we'd like to go down there and visit Vimalakirti's house. Like, what's, you know, what's up with these folks? Let's go down there and check it out. So so this Buddha says to his disciples, he says, noble sons, there aren't any women up there, noble sons, go ahead if you think it is the right time, but lest those living beings become mad and intoxicated, go without your perfumes. In other words, they are so holy, if you will, with perfume, that it's like if we smelled that in our Saha world, we'd just go nuts, right? And we become really jealous. And lest those living beings in the Saha world become jealous of you, change your bodies to hide your beauty. And do not conceive ideas of contempt and aversion for that universe. So don't go down there, you know, thinking that you're hot stuff just because you smell good and look good, right? Why should you not feel this way? Noble sons, a Buddha field is a field of pure space, but the Lord Buddhas, that's Shakyamuni Buddha, in order to develop living beings, do not reveal all at once the pure realm of the Buddha. So this is this Buddha who lives in this pure realm admonishing his disciples to not have a bad attitude about going into the Saha world. Now, you may ask yourself, well, why would they have a bad attitude about going into our world? Well, the reason is because there's a lot of violence in our world. There's a lot of unhappiness in our world. There's a lot of suffering going on in our world. So Vimalakirti, they ask Vimalakirti about this because Vimalakirti, they're kind of, now they're short and sword, they're down in our world and they're sharing stories about how their various Buddhists teach. And so they're asking Vimalakirti about what Shakyamuni Buddha does. And he says, Vimalakirti says, good sirs, these living beings here in our world are hard to discipline. Sound familiar? We are hard to discipline. Therefore, he teaches them with discourses appropriate for the disciplining of the wild and uncivilized. Okay, so this is the world we live in, better known in the United States as the Wild, Wild West, right? And then he says, Vimalakirti continues, thus, by means of these varied explanations of the Dharma, the Buddha trains the minds of those living beings who are just like wild horses. The minds of living beings are just like wild horses. So then the Bodhisattva said, thus is established the greatness of the Buddha Shakyamuni. So they had come to our world thinking, well, you know, Shakyamuni must not be a very kind of on-the-ball Buddha because he's got all these disciples who really kind of don't have their stuff together like we do, right? But the thing about the world of abundant fragrance is that all you have to do is smell and you're enlightened. It's like there's no work involved. It's like you, when you are in that Buddha field, you just sort of take on this perfume. You just, as soon as you eat the food of that field, you start to glow and smell good, and sort of just by your presence, you know, people are enlightened. As we know, it doesn't work that way here in our world. So, so he says, thus is established the greatness of Buddha Shakyamuni. It is marvelous how, concealing his miraculous power, he civilizes the wild living beings who are poor and inferior. And the bodhisattva who settle in the Buddha field of such intense hardships must have inconceivable great compassion. So the bodhisattvas who have the aspiration to practice in this world must have this great and inconceivable great compassion. So then Vimalakirti says, the great compassion of the bodhisattvas who reincarnate here is extremely firm. So those who are reborn in this world, their compassion and their desire and their aspiration for bodhicitta is very firm here in this saha world. So then he talks about the way that we practice in this world. He says, he talks about 10 virtues, but I'm just going to say the first five. And because what he says is that in this world, the way that we understand generosity is because the poor exist. He says, so there is how are they to win the poor by generosity, to win the immoral by morality, to win the hateful by means of tolerance, to win the lazy by means of effort. So here we see that in this world, we are afflicted with these various difficulties. We are afflicted with a kind of poverty. So we can talk about poverty from the perspective of people who actually are in need, who have poverty in that way. But we can talk about the poverty of ourselves, the poverty of the things that we feel that we're missing. Dogen says in the fascicle Uji, he says, is there anything missing right now? Is there anything missing in your world right now? And from a Buddhist perspective, the answer to that question is a resounding no. And yet, as human beings, we say, but there is this longing that we have, this sense that there is something missing. So here, that's where we work with, that's our practice, what we work with. We work with the sense of poverty. We work with our anger. We work with our lack of morality and ethics. We work with all of these various aspects. And from these deficiencies, if you will, in our practice comes our wisdom. Our wisdom can only arrive from our mistakes. So that's how we learn in this world. That's how we learn in the human world, is we learn through our mistakes. So it is part of, from the Vimalakirti Sutra's point of view, from this Mahayana Sutra, it is not expected that we're going to be living in a world of perfection. It is considered to be more efficacious, actually, to be a Buddha in a world where a little work's got to be put into it, a little effort has to be put into that transformation. And then finally, he talks about why a bodhisattva is reborn. So he says the bodhisattva reincarnates voluntarily in the impure Buddha fields, that's us, in the impure Buddha fields in order to purify living beings, right? In order to make the light of wisdom shine and in order to clear away the darkness. So this is the activity of the bodhisattva, the rebirth of the bodhisattva. In early Buddhism, the kind of way that people thought about practice is the Theravadin, what's called the Theravadin path statement, is that the idea is that we accumulate this karma that causes clinging and all of these various things that catapult us into our next rebirth. So the goal of practice is that we clarify our understanding about the nature of ourselves and the world in such a way that we cease to create this kind of clinging karma that causes us to come back into this world, that causes us to be reborn on the wheel of birth and death. From the Mahayana point of view, the bodhisattva is reborn specifically to come back to this world, specifically to come back and work in this world as a bodhisattva, to bring to bring their aspiration for practice, to bring our effort and everything that we can to learn how to be helpful in this world. We say to save all beings, right? Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Now, of course, from one perspective, to say that is like an impossible task. So it's not like we're running around trying to find beings to save. Yet simultaneously, we have this aspiration to learn about the true nature of the world in such a way that our actions are helpful to all beings, that our actions are beneficial to others. So, you know, that's our bodhisattva practice. Sometimes we hit the target, sometimes we miss the target. Dogen says you shoot 100 arrows, 99 arrows, and then one arrow hits the target. So it's this effort that we make, this constant paying attention to, this constant effort to our bodhisattva practice. Our precepts arise from our understanding of this interconnectedness of all being that is the foundation of the bodhisattva practice, that we live in this interconnected, interpenetrating world with each other, so that there's room to include everything. We have to include everything in that. And that means all the difficulties that arise are included in that. We can't just push it away and say, no, that's not part of what I want my life to be. But that's the reality of what it is to live in this world. So here we are. You know, if we say, oh, are you a bodhisattva? Maybe you say, oh, I don't know if I'm a bodhisattva. You know, I just did this silly thing at the supermarket yesterday, or I was just rude, or, you know, I'm like driving my car like a maniac down Highway 9 or something like that. I don't feel very much like a bodhisattva. You should have heard what I said to somebody the other day. But this willingness, this aspiration to learn from that, to keep coming back to that, to keep coming back to our practice. That's our bodhisattva vow. And our bodhisattva vow is that I'm just going to keep being there. I'm going to keep coming back. Pema Chodron has this thing that she does, like when you train puppies, right? You go, stay, stay. So that's our practice. We say to ourselves, stay. Yes, I'm unhappy. Stay, you know, don't go anywhere. This is your practice, you know, to stay right in this moment, to stay present for what's happening right now. So we don't have this expectation that we're going to live in a world without suffering. So one of the things that's kind of associated with this is this kind of delusional way we have about thinking about enlightenment and thinking about how we're doing our practice. So we think, I'm doing my practice to get something. And that something that I'm going to get is enlightenment. And when I get enlightened, everything's going to be great, right? I'm not going to have any more conflicts. I'm never going to have a bad word with anybody. No one is ever going to be rude to me. It's like because, hey, I'm enlightened. So it's like we do these things, we sit zazen, we do ritual, we go to retreats, we do all this stuff, because the idea is that at some point in the future, by doing all these things, I'm going to get to this place called enlightenment. Dogen Zenji says, well, you don't do your practice to get to some place called enlightenment. We do our practice because our practice itself is realization. Our practice itself, the very fact that we practice, is predicated upon some deep sense of our true self. It's kind of like a perpetual motion machine. It's like that true self says, practice, right? And then we practice, and then that reflects the true self. It's like he talks about, Dogen says, the dignified behavior of a Buddha. Our practice, sitting zazen, is the dignified behavior of a Buddha. The dignified behavior of a Buddha is also drinking tea and eating rice. It's also what? Having ice cream. It's also any of those things that we do in our mundane life. Because whenever we read these stories, they say, oh, drinking tea and eating rice. So immediately you think of ancient China, tatami mats, wizened Chinese masters, right? There they are, having their tea and their rice in their enlightened moments. But he's talking about that's what they had to eat, right? They were eating rice and having tea. That was the equivalent of us having, I don't know, Rice Krispies in the morning, oatmeal, something more efficacious here, something healthier. So this way that we are this very being, this very way that we live our daily lives, the effort and practice that we put into our daily lives is the reflection of our realization. So our realization may not be always right on the mark, But that realization has to happen in this moment, and this moment, in this moment. So every moment, we're putting this effort into this practice. So when we go to the grocery store, we put our effort into the practice at the grocery store. So that means that my favorite story about this is you're standing in the express line and there are 15 items and you're counting to see how many items that person actually has, right? So there's a little bit of lack of generosity there in that way of being. So catching ourselves doing those things, catching ourselves and coming back to that place of generosity, coming back to that place of inclusiveness. So one way to look at, to talk about the Four Noble Truths is to talk about them as a medicinal practice. Let's see my notes here. So let's do that for a minute. So you know the Four Noble Truths are: there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, there is an end of suffering, and it's the Eightfold Path. Okay, those are the Four Noble Truths. So there's a way of talking about this, and this is a very, from early Buddhism, talking about the Four Noble Truths as healing, as a kind of medicine for this suffering that we feel, this discord that we feel in our world. So when we say there is suffering, that's like a diagnosis. Now, sometimes or often, you might read a translation that is something like life is suffering, right? Sometimes it's translated that way. But that's not really what Buddhism teaches. What Buddhism teaches is there is suffering, which is different than life is suffering. So the Buddhist teaching is not some kind of, you know, we have to suffer every moment of our waking lives. That's sort of like we're born into some kind of hell realm of suffering. No, it's that we experience suffering. And part of that experience of suffering does come from being in a body, right? The kind of body-mind senses that we have. But, you know, when you think about it, to say there is suffering, animals experience suffering, plants experience suffering. I think in the form realm, we experience suffering. You know, maybe rocks experience suffering. I don't know. I don't know what it's like to be a rock, but maybe getting moved is problematic. You know, I don't want to be moved. No, I don't want you to take me out of the Tassara Creek bed. I want you to leave me here, you know. So we don't know what rocks think. But this way of realizing that just that there is suffering. And then the second one is there's a cause of suffering. So the technical definition of the cause of suffering is ignorance, right? Ignorance about the true nature of what it is to be in this world. So usually we talk about, we say, well, there's greed, right? We suffer because we want something and we can't get it, right? Or we suffer because we reject something. So we're getting something we don't want. There's also a third called the suffering of re-becoming, which is where we become attached to defining ourselves in a certain way and trying to control that way of how we define ourselves. So we might define ourselves in a way that we think is like, we're really attached to the fact that I've got a PhD, or I've got a brown rock suit and you've got a blue rock suit, or I don't know, I'm trying to think of stuff here. You know, I drive a Mercedes and you drive a something else, you know, that's not as classy as a Mercedes. All those kinds of attachments that we get hooked on, these ways that we think about our life, or I'm this or I'm that. But of course, we are absolutely none of those things. But we get caught up in that and attached to that. We get attached to practice. I should be this way. I'm a Buddhist practitioner, so I should always be patient. So we start to suffer when we're not patient all the time. We somehow can't accept that. So it's this way that we have this greed about wanting to be something or get something, this desire to get rid of it, and this desire to continue to perpetuate a notion of self, a notion of who we are, a story about who it is that we are. So maybe one of the reasons this happens for us is because we're in bodies and we have certain, you know, we have eyes and ears and nose. I was talking about this yesterday at the lecture I gave at Ocean Gate, and, you know, it's funny about we feel so separate, and I wonder if one of the reasons is because you know, we're inside this kind of perceptual apparatus, so we feel like we're looking outside of our body. And not only that, particularly as Westerners in the United States anyway, we have this notion of our brain is disconnected from our body. So it's almost like we kind of think that there's this little person up there, you know, who's doing the talking here. So I don't know, maybe they're right in here somewhere, you know. If we do a dissection of my brain, there'd be a little shinshu up there. Oh, we're going to say this now, we're going to do that now, right? You guys are listening, your little people are up there doing their thing. But of course, that's not really the nature of who we are. We are, but I think that being in bodies like this, we tend to separate in that way. So we have to pay attention to that. We have to be aware of that desire to separate, that aware of when that kind of separation is not particularly helpful. You know, we are separate beings. Buddhism, we carry simultaneously the particular, right? That we are particular beings, and simultaneously we are a whole part of a totality. We make this totality. And in that way, we are not separate. We are completely interconnected, completely interpenetrating. Yet simultaneously, there is this separateness. So how do we do both of those things at the same time? Katagiri Roshi would say, super speed. Remember you go like you say, super speed, like this, right? So sometimes it's appropriate to be that separate particular person. And sometimes it's appropriate to be that, to be aware of and respond from that total interconnected place. And the only way we know what that is to play with that, right? To make those mistakes, to see that wisdom, to have those things going on simultaneously, to pay attention to that. How is this right now? What is this right now? What's happening right now? You know? Who is this person in this body right now? What is it that I see? You know? What is it like for the other person? What is it they see? So this simultaneity of the particular and the universal happening. So this way that we are aware of how our disconnect causes suffering. We become aware of this greed, hate, and delusion, right? Greed is also wanting things to stay the same, right? When you're greedy about something, when there's a sense of loss and you want it, you know, it's like you want something to stay the same. You don't want things to change. Hatred, in a way, is something like, I want things to change. I want to get rid of this thing. I want it to change. So this way that we're constantly caught up in not being willing to accept our lives just as they are, wanting something different to be going on, wanting something to happen that's different than what it is, wanting to be somewhere else. So this way that in the midst of our suffering, going back to the original theme of the talk, talking about the difficulties of being in the midst of what we consider to be a kind of overwhelming suffering that we're experiencing right now with various things that are happening in the United States, this desire to kind of want to escape from that, to not be present for that. And yet our bodhisattva practice has to be that we are willing to presence ourselves for that. It doesn't mean that you have to run off to Boston, right? Bodhisattva practice, it doesn't mean that we have to do something extraordinary in our lives to practice. Sometimes we think practice is like, oh, I've got to go to another place. I have to go to some other place and practice. And if you can do that, and that works for you, and it makes you happy, I think that's wonderful. If you can go and be a member of Doctors Without Borders, that's a great thing. So I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. But what I'm saying is our tendency is to think it's over there, right? The practice is over there. But the practice is not over there another day, another time. The practice is right here. The practice is waking up to our greed, waking up to our hate, waking up to our delusion. Maybe hate's too strong a word. Waking up to our impatience. Waking up to those things, finding the subtleness in our actions, and not condemning ourselves. This is not about, oh, I just found this thing out about myself, so now I have to like go beat myself over the head, or I have to cut this thing out, or something. This kind of violence. It's a kind of gentle befriending of the parts of yourself that are difficult. Because when we don't befriend those aspects of ourselves, what happens is they either go underground or it becomes like an enemy. So we don't need enemies like that. We don't need to disavow who we are. It is, as Jaku, who works with the Jodo Shin, talks about, they have this expression, foolish human beings. We are foolish human beings. We're the human beings who have the minds like wild horses. We're the ones that we need the special Shakyamuni Buddha to come down and help us out. So it's like this way that we realize that it's okay. It's important change, and simultaneously it's okay. That this really is the source of our wisdom. If you didn't have difficulties in your life, how could you help someone else who has difficulties in their life? If we'd never had anything bad happen to us, if we'd never done anything stupid, if we'd never done anything that was mean, how could we understand what it was like to do that? How could we find patience with that? How could we realize our empathy and interconnectedness if we hadn't also experienced something like that, that somebody else is struggling with? And we want to extend to ourselves the same kind of patience and generosity. Not a kind of idiot compassion where, you know, we just do whatever we want to do, but this way that we gently guide ourselves and don't beat ourselves up. So the third is that there is a cure, and that, so part of that is usually the third, would you would just say, well, there's a cure, and it's paying attention to, it's working with these various aspects. And then the Eightfold Path is, probably most of you know, it's like there, it's right livelihood, I'm bad at lists, I'm Zen, right, we don't do lists, right livelihood, maybe you can help me, does anybody know the Eightfold Path? Right concentration, right speech, right effort, right action. Yeah, those kinds of things, right? Anybody think of any other ones? So this way in which the basis of that is coming back to this wisdom and compassion and skillful means. Wisdom is this interconnected life that we live. That's what wisdom means. Wisdom means is technically means that we live in this interconnected world. Things lack inherent existence. Everything is interpenetrating and interconnected. What is compassion? Compassion is passion with. Compassion is that actualizing that reality that we are all one. At the same time that we're particular, we're all one. And skillful means is, how do we respond to that? How do we actualize that? So this end of suffering is this effort that we make every day, this effort that we make continuously to wake up to the true nature of our lives. Dogen wrote in Zui Monkey, he said, think only of this day and this hour, for tomorrow is an uncertain thing, and no one knows what the future will bring. Make up your mind to follow Buddhism as if you had only this day to live, to make it flourish and bring benefits to all beings. So make up your mind to follow Buddhism as if you only had this day to live. Only this day. What are we going to do in this day? How are we going to pay attention to our practice in this day? How are we going to realize that and acknowledge that our practice is our realization? This practice that we engage in right now, in this moment, in this day, is the actualization of what we understand about the true nature of reality. That may mature and change over time, but we must express as best we can in this moment. So we have to do that in the supermarket. We have to do that while we're driving our car. Driving our car is like some vast mandala. Driving seriously, driving is like, if you think about, let's think about someplace like Santa Cruz, because I don't know this area so much, but maybe up in Boulder Creek or something. If you think about that whole area, all these people are driving around. It is a completely interconnected event happening. And in the midst of that interconnected event, we have to respond from that place of interconnection. We have to respond from that place of skillfulness. So that means that we stop at stop signs. It means that we go with green lights. It means that this may sound all very mundane to you, but this is practice realization. You shouldn't denigrate your daily activities. If you did not engage in this practice, if you did not engage in your driving as if you're driving with all beings, because you are, it's not an as if, you really are driving with all beings. So in that moment that somebody pulls in front of you and they do something stupid, that's the moment of our practice. That's the moment of our effort. That's the moment of our generosity. That's the moment of working with our anger, if that's what arises, or working with our fear, if that's what arises. Or the moment when we do something stupid like that when we are driving our car, and we hope that the person behind us is not going to track us down and, you know, yell at us or something like that. I don't know about you. I've occasionally done a few stupid things in my life, driving my car. And I find it really scary when people get angry. You know, you never know what they're going to do. What a great gift it is to each other when we don't respond that way. That's practice. That's a realized response. What else could it be? You know, this is our daily lives. This is the cure. There is suffering. So how do we benefit all beings? How do we respond to our life right now, just as it is, in this moment, not wasting a moment, not beating ourselves up, with generosity and sanity in each moment? So how does that happen? And it can only happen because we do the practice. No one else could do the practice. We do it right now in this moment. That's the cure for suffering. That's what it is to live in this Saha world. It's what Dogen says, you know, that's the shooting the 100 arrows and hitting it once, hitting the target once. Or maybe you'll hit it 3 times in a row and then you'll miss it. Because it happens in this moment. Enlightenment isn't something that like you get it and then you keep it and you never have to work at it again. Like it's somehow, it's like something that you, you know, you did all this stuff and now you're enlightened. It doesn't work that way. Enlightened response is actualizing this moment and this moment and this moment. In the Tenso Kyokan, there's a little poem that Dogen talks about. He says, you know, the moon is in this wave and the next. So imagine, you know, waves coming into the shore and the moon reflected on the waves. The moon is actualization, realization, right? It's in this moment and the next moment. Each one of those is a new moment. Each one of those is a new opportunity. Each one of those is a time for us to engage and practice realization and knowing that they're not separate from each other. This way that we just, that's our effort, you know, just gently come back, come back, come back, this moment and this moment. That's the cure for suffering. there isn't some expectation that we're not going to suffer, because we are going to suffer. But how is it that we, if you will, that we can suffer with a kind of equanimity in the midst of our suffering? Realizing this shared life that we all live, this shared desire for things. In the Genja Koan, there's the first four lines of the Genja Koan. Dogen ends it with, you probably know this, something like, and yet blossoms fall and weeds spread. So he has this quality of, this is our lives. Much as we want it to be like this universal, unobstructed, no suffering kind of life, and yet, weeds spread, blossoms fall. This is the nature of our life. This is the nature of what it is to be a human being. This is the nature of what it is to live in the Saha world. So we just, in the midst of that, not rejecting that, not trying to get rid of that, but realizing that that is what it is, accepting our lives as they are right now, the midst of our suffering, there is also this sanity. There's also this practice. There's also this effort that we make, coming back, and coming back. So what do you all think about that?
What else can we do?
That's a very good question. What else can we do? I actually have that here in big letters. What else can we do? You know. Yes.
I can't stop having it come into my mind with the first part of your talk, which is quite wonderful, but the notion of flowers and fragrance.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was before that or after that, with all these catastrophes of media, and just thinking what that would do if you could bring that fragrance down into that mayhem of, and just the fragrance of flower. Like, I have this lilac bush in the back of my yard, and it's one of the older ones. It's not a hybrid, and it's just, you smell it, and it's like immediately, it's like, for a moment, at least, everything's kind of soft and gentle, and I would embrace anybody who would be right next to me.
But, you know, our version of that is all the people who immediately ran back to the bomb site and started to help those people who were injured. That's the fragrance of the tree in the backyard. That's the flip side of this, is all those people, and forget about whether they're Buddhists or not, who knows, who cares? All those people who just immediately responded because they had the sense of connection. They have the sense of wanting to help, the sense of, this is my effort and practice right now, mm-hmm. is to, what can I do? You know, how can I respond? That's the fragrance of the tree.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I was thinking more simply primitive, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the smell. How incredibly therapeutic that is. Just the smell. And if you could, like, this whole room filled with flowers like that, what that would do. So you have these people that are incredible, maniacal, these maniacal feeling, whatever, all these incredible hatred, and you fill a room full of flowers, have them sit down, well, what would happen?
You might make them very mad. I don't know.
Just for an instant, might be that moment that you're kind of talking about, though.
It could be. There might be. Which actually makes me think about the very end of my talk, which is that, we also need to take care of ourselves. To do this practice, we need to take care of ourselves. So, in your case, you need to go out and smell your flowers in the backyard. I'm serious. You know, we have to, take care of ourselves, too. We can't expect ourselves to be running around looking for suffering in order to be able to respond to it. We have to give ourselves some ease. I wrote down some things like, but here you guys, you're already out in this beautiful environment, but take a walk, But I also know from living at Tassajara for 4 years, we lived there for 4 years, that when you live in community, stuff happens. It may be the most beautiful place in the world, and you still are like, this person is driving me crazy, you know, or it's too cold. I hate the fact that it's so cold here, or gosh, it's hot, and there are all these bugs, you know. So there's always the possibility arising for this kind of like, I don't want it, I want it, I'm not getting it, those kinds of feelings to arise. But, you know, that we do find ways to take care of ourselves. Being a bodhisattva, this just includes taking care of yourself. So I just wanted to say that. Yeah.
So not all of us have straight arrows.
Yes.
To shoot with, and
yeah,
sometimes they're bent or curved or whatnot,
yeah,
and but we still have to shoot.
Yeah, we do. That's our practice. We still have to shoot. We still shoot. And somehow in the midst of that shooting, all those bent arrows, they're not wasted.
Some of them hit.
Some of them hit. Some of them are curveballs, and they go right straight down over the plate. You know, it's like, you don't know. You just have to give it your absolute best effort. You know, we say you can see as far as your eye of practice can see, right? So we practice and we practice and we practice and which is also from Dogen's point of view, you know, he says, this is really wonderful. Practice is realization. When we practice, it's coming from that place of realization. So that's a wonderfully encouraging thing. Even in the midst of your missing the mark, it's still coming from that place of actualization. So please be encouraged by that. You know, he is encouraging us. He's doing very good, bodhisattvas. Keep shooting those arrows.
And once you hit the mark,
then there's another one.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next moment,
yeah,
right?
Next moment. And so really, you hit the mark in one moment. It's the mistake for the next moment.
Maybe, maybe not.
And so you have to shoot again and step forward again.
That's right.
Give another shot.
That's right. Because we are always, you know, in this midst of response. Always having response. What does that mean? Is it lunch?
Yeah, but we have time to wrap up.
So oh, good, good. So there's this way in which you know, we say no gaining idea. That's no gaining idea, right? It's like, because that's another thing in spiritual practice. We have a good period of zazen and we want more, right? And then our next period of zazen is just not quite up to snuff. And so we suffer. And then so we're like going, oh, can I have like 5 of these in a row? You know, like really good periods of zazen. So this way that, you know, each time we go to the cushion, each moment that we engage is a new moment. A new moment. Which is really wonderful because it means that if you made a mistake in the last moment, this is a new moment. So.
But there's there are some times where the ripening is such that things really work.
Yeah, that's true.
And yet you can't be attached to that because in that time when those things really work, maybe all those circumstances have come to fruition, and now you have to turn to the new conditions that are ripening.
Yeah, Dogen talks about in Genjo Koan, he says, to carry the self forward is delusion, to allow myriad things to come forth is realization. So when we respond to something, if to carry the self forward means that we're attached to a certain outcome, it means that, oh, I did it right last time. In your case, we're talking about, oh, I did it right last time. I want to do it right this time. Or this worked last time, so it must work this time. So that's a way in which we're carrying the self forward. Allowing myriad things to come forward is to allow the totality of that situation to present itself. So if you're having a difficult conversation with someone and you go into that conversation with preconceived ideas about who they are, which is you don't like them, right? So you can't have a fresh moment with that person because you have all these ideas about that person. Or maybe you went into the moment with the last time this person came to me with a problem, I said the right thing to them. So maybe I can say the same thing to them. But actually, it doesn't work that way. You just have to really present yourself without any preconceived ideas about what this moment is. That's allowing myriad things to come forward and meet you, which includes you. You're one of the myriad things, okay? So we're not talking about you let people abuse you or yell at you or something like that. We're talking about it's this mutuality of expression that happens. It's not you, it's not like us, them. It's this mutuality that comes forward. When that arises, then your response is going to be skillful means, in all likelihood. At that point, that's realization. Those are those skillful responses. We do it all the time without thinking about it. We really do. You know, Duggan also says we're Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas who do not even know that we're Buddhas actualizing Buddhas. We always say, well, I'm not a Buddha, so that doesn't apply to me. That must be some kind of cosmic beings up there doing something. But you do it all the time. And I'll go back to driving. When you drive your car around and you're following the rules of the road and you're being generous and you're being attentive and you're actually responding to all the myriad things that are happening simultaneously in that moment, that's actualized response. That's making the world a better place. That really is. And you're a Buddha. You don't even know that you're actualizing being a Buddha in that moment. Because to you, it's some trivial activity that somehow isn't about Buddhism. It's not about spirituality. It's just, hey, I'm just going to the grocery store. Well, where else are you going to do your practice? Is it only here? The only place you practice is when you come to Jokoji? Or you go to a temple somewhere, you sit zazen? Is that the only place we practice? No. We practice in our all the time. All the time. Keep, you know, like bent straight arrows. Keep. So.
Some circumstances are really tough to meet. And so I guess that's why we have to keep meeting them to see how we adjust. Like, you know, walking down the streets of San Francisco and on my way to work, there are 8 guys lined up along the cyclone fence because that's where they slept last night.
Yeah.
And, yeah, how to do you engage them? Do you pity them? Do you, it's rich.
I think you have to include yourself in that. You have to include maybe what it is for me today is to just say hello. Hi, guys. See them every day you walk by. Hi, guys. That's all. Just say, we're human beings together. I don't have to take them home with me. I don't have to, like, you know, because I think we tend to go to these extremes. Like, if I don't do this thing, I'm not really practicing. But maybe all that's required in that moment is just, hi, good morning. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So that we really, that's just meeting the moment. And we have to include our own ability in that moment. If we do stuff that we think we should do because that's good practice, then we're not going to do a very good job with it. You know, we're going to be resentful. It's going to be too much for us. We're going to have pushed ourselves over a line. So we need to pay attention to that.
Is there something about joyous spontaneity?
Yeah, that's good. I like joyous spontaneity. But we can't always do joyous spontaneity. You know?
I've just been trying to figure out where Tao and Zen come together. I think Tao is something associated with that joyous, natural, joyous spontaneity.
I think natural, joyous spontaneity is super. And sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we have natural, unjoyous sadness and grief, you know, in the midst of our lives too. How are we going to respond to this stuff? How are we going to do this? And I think it's just this moment and this moment and this moment and this moment. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.